Making you do chores doesn't sound too bad.
He calls us orphans.
He has terrible friends.
He is always asking about our money.
Pucko!
Mr. Poe put up his hands to indicate he had heard enough.
Children, children, you must give yourselves time to adjust to your new home. You've only been there a few days.
We have been there long enough to know Count Olaf is a bad man.
Mr. Poe looked at each of the three children. His face was kind, but it didn't look like he really believed what the Baudelaire orphans were saying.
Are you familiar with the Latin term in loco parentis?
Violet and Sunny looked at Klaus. The biggest reader of the three, he was the most likely to know vocabulary words and foreign phrases.
Something about trains?
Maybe Mr. Poe was going to take them by train to another relative. Mr. Poe shook his head.
In loco parentis means acting in the role of parent. It is a legal term, and it applies to Count Olaf. Now that you're in his care, the Count may raise you using any methods he sees fit. I'm sorry if your parents did not make you do any household chores, or if you never saw them drink any wine, or if you like their friends better than Count Olaf's friends. But these are things that you must get used to, as Count Olaf is acting in loco parentis. Understand?
But he struck my brother. Look at his face.
As Violet spoke, Mr. Poe reached into his pocket for his handkerchief and, covering his mouth, coughed many, many times into it. He coughed so loudly that Violet could not be certain he had heard her.
Whatever Count Olaf has done, he has acted in loco parentis, and there's nothing I can do about it.
Mr. Poe glanced down at one of his papers and circled a number.
Your money will be well protected by myself and by the bank, but Count Olaf's parenting techniques are his own business. Now, I hate to usher you out post-haste, but I have very much work to do.
The children just sat there, stunned.
Post-haste means...
Means you'll do nothing to help us.
Violet was shaking with anger and frustration. She stood up and walked out of the room, followed by Klaus, who was carrying Sunny. They stalked out of the bank and stood on the street, not knowing what to do next.
What shall we do next?
Violet stared up at the sky. She wished she could invent something that could take them out of there.
It's getting a bit late. We might as well just go back and think of something else tomorrow. Perhaps we can stop and see Justice Strauss.
But you said she wouldn't help us.
Not for help. For books.
It is very useful, when one is young, to learn the difference between literally and figuratively. If something happens literally, it actually happens. If something happens figuratively, it feels like it's happening. If you are literally jumping for joy, for instance, it means you are leaping in the air because you are very happy. If you are figuratively jumping for joy, it means you are so happy that you could jump for joy, but are saving your energy for other matters. The Baudelaire orphans walked back to Count Olaf's neighborhood and stopped at the home of Justice Strauss, who welcomed them inside and let them choose books from the library. Violet chose several about mechanical inventions. Klaus chose several about wolves, and Sunny found a book with many pictures of teeth inside. They then went to their room and crowded together on the one bed, reading intently and happily. Figuratively, they escaped from Count Olaf and their miserable existence. They did not literally escape, because they were still in his house and vulnerable to Olaf's evil in loco parentis ways. But by immersing themselves in their favorite reading topics, they felt far away from their predicament, as if they had escaped. In the situation of the orphans, figuratively escaping was not enough, of course, but at the end of a tiring and hopeless day, it would have to do. Violet, Klaus, and Sunny read their books, and in the back of their minds, hoped that soon their figurative escape would eventually turn into a literal one. The next morning, When the children stumbled sleepily from their bedroom into the kitchen, rather than a note from Count Olaf, they found Count Olaf himself.
Good morning, orphans. I have your oatmeal all ready in bowls for you.
The children took seats at the kitchen table and stared nervously into their oatmeal. If you knew Count Olaf, and he suddenly served you a meal, wouldn't you be afraid there was something terrible in it, like poison or ground glass? But instead, Violet, Klaus, and Sunny found that fresh raspberries had been sprinkled on top of each of their portions. The Baudelaire orphans hadn't had raspberries since their parents died, although they were extremely fond of them.
Thank you.
Klaus picked up one of the raspberries and examined it. Perhaps these were poison berries that just looked like delicious ones. Count Olaf, seeing how suspiciously Klaus was looking at the berries, smiled and plucked a berry out of Sunny's bowl. Looking at each of the three youngsters, he popped it into his mouth and ate it.
Aren't raspberries delicious? They were my favorite berries when I was your age.
Violet tried to picture Count Olaf as a youngster, but couldn't. His shiny eyes, bony hands, and shadowy smile all seemed to be things only adults possess. Despite her fear of him, however, she took her spoon in her right hand and began to eat her oatmeal. Count Olaf had eaten some, so it probably wasn't poisonous, and anyway, she was very hungry. Klaus began to eat too, as did Sunny, who got oatmeal and raspberries all over her face.
I received a phone call yesterday from Mr. Poe. He told me you children had been to see him.
The children exchanged glances. They had hoped their visit would be taken in confidence, a phrase which here means kept a secret between Mr. Poe and themselves, and not blabbed to Count Olaf.
Mr. Poe told me that you appeared to be having some difficulty adjusting to the life I have so graciously provided for you. I'm very sorry to hear that.
The children looked at Count Olaf. His face was very serious, as if he were very sorry to hear that, but his eyes were shiny and bright, the way they are when someone is telling a joke.
Is that so? I'm sorry Mr. Poe bothered you.
I'm glad he did, because I want the three of you to feel at home here, now that I am your father.
The children shuddered a little at that, remembering their own kind father, and gazing sadly at the poor substitute now sitting across the table from them.
Lately I have been very nervous about my performances with the theatre troupe, and I'm afraid I may have acted a bit standoffish.
The word standoffish is a wonderful one, but it does not describe Count Olaf's behaviour toward the children. It means reluctant to associate with others, and it might describe somebody who, during a party, would stand in a corner and not talk to anyone. It would not describe somebody who provides one bed for three people to sleep in, forces them to do horrible chores, and strikes them across the face. There are many words for people like that, but standoffish is not one of them. Klaus knew the word standoffish and almost laughed out loud at Olaf's incorrect use of it, but his face still had a bruise on it, so Klaus remained silent.
Therefore, to make you feel a little more at home here, I would like to have you participate in my next play. Perhaps if you took part in the work I do, you would be less likely to run off complaining to Mr. Poe.
In what way would we participate?
Violet was thinking of all the chores they already did for Count Olaf, and was not in the mood to do more.
Well, the play is called The Marvelous Marriage, and it is written by the great playwright Al Funcoot. We will give only one performance on this Friday night. It is about a man who is very brave and intelligent, played by me. In the finale, he marries the young, beautiful woman he loves, in front of a crowd of cheering people. You, Klaus, and you, Sonny, will play some of the cheering people in the crowd.
But we're shorter than most adults. Won't that look strange to the audience?
You will be playing two midgets who attend the wedding.
And what will I do? I am very handy with tools, so perhaps I could help you build the set.
Oh, build the set? Heavens no! A pretty girl like you shouldn't be working backstage.
But I'd like to.
Count Olaf's one eyebrow raised slightly, and the Baudelaire orphans recognized this sign of his anger. But then the eyebrow went down again, as he forced himself to remain calm.
But I have such an important role for you on stage. You are going to play the young woman I marry.
Violet felt her oatmeal and raspberries shift around in her stomach, as if she had just caught the flu. It was bad enough having Count Olaf acting in loco parentis and announcing himself as their father, but to consider this man her husband, even for the purposes of a play, was even more dreadful.
It's a very important role.
Count Olaf's mouth curled up into an unconvincing smile.
Although you have no lines other than I do, which you will say when Justice Strauss asks you if you will have me.
Justice Strauss? What does she have to do with it?
She has agreed to play the part of the judge.
Behind Count Olaf, one of the eyes painted on the kitchen walls closely watched over each of the Baudelaire children.
I asked Justice Strauss to participate because I wanted to be neighborly, as well as fatherly.
Count Olaf, father, I'm not sure I'm talented enough to perform professionally. I would hate to disgrace your good name and the name of Al Funcoot. Plus, I'll be very busy in the next few weeks working on my inventions and learning how to prepare roast beef.
Count Olaf reached out one of his spidery hands and stroked Violet on the chin, looking deep into her eyes.
You will participate in this theatrical performance. I would prefer it if you would participate voluntarily, but as I believe Mr. Poe explained to you, I can order you to participate, and you must obey.
Olaf's sharp and dirty fingernails gently scratched on Violet's chin, and she shivered. The room was very, very quiet, as Olaf finally let go and stood up and left the room without a word. The Baudelaire children listened to his heavy footsteps go up the stairs to the tower they were forbidden to enter.
Well, I guess it won't hurt to be in the play. It seems to be very important to him, and we want to keep on his good side.
But he must be up to something.
You don't think those berries were poison, do you?
No. Olaf is after the fortune we will inherit. Killing us would do him no good.
But what good does it do him to have us be in this stupid play?
I don't know.
Violet stood up and started washing out the oatmeal bowls.
I wish we knew something more about inheritance law. I'll bet Count Olaf has cooked up some plan to get our money, but I don't know what it could be.
I guess we could ask Mr. Poe about it. He knows all those Latin legal phrases.
But Mr. Poe would probably call Count Olaf again, and then he'd know we were on to him. Maybe we should try to talk to Justice Strauss. She's a judge, so she must know all about the law.
But she's also Olaf's neighbor, and she might tell him that we had asked.
Klaus took his glasses off, which he often did when he was thinking hard.
How could we find out about the law without Olaf's knowledge?
Book!
Sunny probably meant, would somebody please wipe my face? But it made Violet and Klaus look at each other. They were both thinking the same thing.
Count Olaf didn't leave us any chores to do, so I suppose we are free to visit Justice Strauss and her library.
Yes, indeed. And you know, today I don't think I'll choose a book on wolves.
Nor I one on mechanical engineering. I think I'd like to read about inheritance law.
Well, let's go. Justice Strauss said we could come over soon, and we don't want to be standoffish.
At the mention of the word that Count Olaf had used so ridiculously, the Baudelaire orphans all laughed, even Sunny, who of course did not have a very big vocabulary. Swiftly, they put away the clean oatmeal bowls in the kitchen cupboards, which watched them with painted eyes. Then the three young people ran next door. Friday, the day of the performance, was only a few days off, and the children wanted to figure out Count Olaf's plan as quickly as possible. There are many, many types of books, and books on tape, and everybody wants to enjoy something different. For instance, people who hate stories in which terrible things happen to small children should turn this audio program off immediately. One type of book that practically no one likes to read is a book about the law. Books about the law are notorious for being very long, very dull, and very difficult to read. This is one reason many lawyers make heaps of money. The money is an incentive. The word incentive here means an offered reward to persuade you to do something you don't want to do. To read long, dull, and difficult books. The Baudelaire children had a slightly different incentive for reading these books, of course. Their incentive was not heaps of money, but preventing Count Olaf from doing something horrible to them in order to get heaps of money. But even with this incentive, getting through the law books in Justice Strauss's private library was a very, very, very hard task.
Oh, goodness! I thought you were interested in mechanical engineering, animals of North America, and teeth! Are you sure you want to read those enormous law books? Even I don't like reading them, and I work in law!
Yes, I find them very interesting, Justice Strauss.
So do I. Violet and I are considering a career in law, so we are fascinated by these books.
Well, Sunny can't possibly be interested. Maybe she'd like to come help me with the gardening.
Whippy!
Which meant I'd much prefer gardening to sitting around watching my siblings struggle through law books.
Well, make sure she doesn't eat any dirt.
Of course. We wouldn't want her to be sick for the big performance.
Violet and Klaus exchanged a look.
Are you excited about the play?
Oh, yes. I've always wanted to perform on stage, ever since I was a little girl. And now Count Olaf has given me the opportunity to live my lifelong dream. Aren't you thrilled to be a part of the theater?
I guess so.
Of course you are.
Klaus passed his younger sister over to Justice Strauss, who left the library with stars in her eyes and Sunny in her hands.
She's stage struck. She won't believe that Count Olaf is up to something, no matter what.
She wouldn't help us anyway. She's a judge, and she'd just start babbling about in loco parentis like Mr. Poe.
That's why we've got to find a legal reason to stop the performance. Have you found anything in your book yet?
Violet glanced down at a scrap of paper on which she had been taking notes.
Nothing helpful. 50 years ago, there was a woman who left an enormous sum of money to her pet weasel, and none to her three sons. The three sons tried to prove that the woman was insane, so the money would go to them.
What happened?
I think the weasel died, but I'm not sure. I have to look up some of the words.
I don't think it's going to help us anyway.
Maybe Count Olaf is trying to prove that we are insane, so he'd get the money.
But why would making us be in the marvelous marriage prove we were insane?
I don't know. I'm stuck. Have you found anything?
Around the time of your weasel lady, a group of actors put on a production of Shakespeare's Macbeth, and none of them wore any clothing.
You mean they were all naked on stage?
Only briefly. The police came and shut down the production. I don't think that's very helpful either. It was just pretty interesting to read about.
Maybe Count Olaf isn't up to anything. I'm not interested in performing in his play, but perhaps we're all worked up about nothing. Maybe Count Olaf really is just trying to welcome us into the family.
How can you say that? He struck me across the face!
But there's no way he can get hold of our fortune just by putting us in a play. My eyes are tired from reading these books, Klaus, and they aren't helping us. I'm going to go out and help Justice Strauss in the garden.
Klaus watched his sister leave the library and felt a wave of hopelessness wash over him. The day of the performance was not far off, and he hadn't even figured out what Count Olaf was up to, let alone how to stop him. All his life, Klaus had believed that if you read enough books, you could solve any problem. But now he wasn't so sure.
You there! Count Olaf sent me to look for you. You're to return to the house immediately.
Klaus turned and saw one of the members of Count Olaf's theater troupe, the one with hooks for hands, standing in the doorway.
What are you doing in this musty old room anyway? Inheritance law and its implications? Why are you reading that?
Why do you think I'm reading it?
The man put one of his terrible hooks on Klaus's shoulder.
I'll tell you what I think. I think you should never be allowed inside this library again, at least until Friday. We don't want a little boy getting big ideas. Now, where is your sister and that hideous baby?
Klaus shrugged the hook off his shoulder.
In the garden. Why don't you go and get them?
The man leaned over until his face was just inches from Klaus's, so close that the man's features flickered into a blur. He breathed out foul steam with every word.
Listen to me very carefully, little boy. The only reason Count Olaf hasn't torn you limb from limb is that he hasn't gotten hold of your money. He allows you to live while he works out his plans. But ask yourself this, you little bookworm. What reason will he have to keep you alive after he has your money? What do you think will happen to you then?
Klaus felt an icy chill go through him as the horrible man spoke. He had never been so terrified in all his life. He found that his arms and legs were shaking uncontrollably, as if he were having some sort of fit. His mouth was making strange sounds, like Sonny always did, as he struggled to find something to say.
When the time comes, I believe Count Olaf just might leave you to me. So if I were you, I'd start acting a little nicer.
The man stood up again and put both his hooks in front of Klaus's face, letting the light from the reading lamps reflect off the wicked-looking devices.
Now, if you will excuse me, I have to fetch your poor orphan siblings.
Klaus felt his body go limp as the hook-handed man left the room, and he wanted to sit there for a moment and catch his breath, but his mind wouldn't let him. This was his last moment in the library, and perhaps his last opportunity to foil Count Olaf's plan, but what to do? Hearing the faint sounds of the hook-handed man talking to Justice Strauss in the garden, Klaus looked frantically around the library for something that could be helpful. Then, just as he heard the man's footsteps heading back his way, Klaus spied one book and quickly grabbed it. He untucked his shirt and put the book inside, hastily re-tucking it, just as the hook-handed man re-entered the library, escorting Violet and carrying Sunny, who was trying, without success, to bite the man's hooks.
I'm ready to go.
Klaus walked out the door before the man could get a good look at him. He walked quickly ahead of his siblings, hoping that nobody would notice the book-shaped lump in his shirt. Maybe, just maybe, the book Klaus was smuggling could save their lives. Klaus stayed up all night reading, which was normally something he loved to do. Back when his parents were alive, Klaus used to take a flashlight to bed with him and hide under the covers, reading until he couldn't keep his eyes open. Some mornings, his father would come into Klaus's room to wake him up and find him asleep, still clutching his flashlight in one hand and his book in the other. But on this particular night, of course, the circumstances were much different. Klaus stood by the window, squinting as he read his smuggled book by the moonlight that trickled into the room. He occasionally glanced at his sisters. Violet was sleeping fitfully, a word which here means with much tossing and turning on the lumpy bed, and Sunny had wormed her way into the pile of curtains so that she just looked like a small heap of cloth. Klaus had not told his siblings about the book because he didn't want to give them false hope. He wasn't sure the book would help them out of their dilemma. The book was long and difficult to read, and Klaus became more and more tired as the night wore on. Occasionally his eyes would close. He found himself reading the same sentence over and over. He found himself reading the same sentence over and over. He found himself reading the same sentence over and over, but then he would remember the way the hook hands of Count Olaf's associate had glinted in the library, and would imagine them tearing into his flesh, and he would wake right up and continue reading. He found a small scrap of paper and tore it into strips, which he used to mark significant parts of the book. By the time the light outside grew grey with the approaching dawn, Klaus had found out all he needed to know. His hopes rose along with the sun. Finally, when the first few birds began to sing, Klaus tiptoed to the door of the bedroom and eased it open quietly, careful not to wake the restless Violet or Sunny, who was still hidden in the pile of curtains. Then he went to the kitchen and sat and waited for Count Olaf. He didn't have to wait long before he heard Olaf tromping down the tower stairs. When Count Olaf walked into the kitchen, he saw Klaus sitting at the table and smirked, a word which here means smiled in an unfriendly, phony way.
Hello, orphan. You're up early.
Klaus's heart was beating fast, but he felt calm on the outside, as if he had on a layer of invisible armor.
I've been up all night, reading this book.
He put the book out on the table so Olaf could see it.
It's called Nuptial Law, and I learned many interesting things while reading it.
Count Olaf had taken out a bottle of wine to pour himself some breakfast, but when he saw the book, he stopped and sat down.
The word nuptial means relating to marriage.
I know what the word means. Where did you get that book?
From Justice Strauss's library. But that's not important. What's important is that I've found out your plan.
Count Olaf raised an eyebrow.
Is that so? And what is my plan, you little runt?
Klaus ignored the insult and opened the book to where one of the scraps of paper was marking his place.
The laws of marriage in this community are very simple. The requirements are as follows. The presence of a judge, a statement of I do by both the bride and the groom, and the signing of an explanatory document in the bride's own hand. If my sister says I do and signs a piece of paper while Justice Strauss is in the room, then she is legally married. This play you're putting on shouldn't be called the Marvelous Marriage. It should be called the Menacing Marriage. You're not going to marry Violet figuratively. You're going to marry her literally. This play won't be pretend. It will be real and legally binding.
Your sister isn't old enough to get married.
She can get married if she has the permission of her legal guardian, acting in loco parentis. I read that too. You can't fool me.
Why in the world would I want to actually marry your sister? It is true, she is very pretty, but a man like myself can acquire any number of beautiful women.
Klaus turned to a different section of nuptial law.
A legal husband has the right to control any money in the possession of his legal wife. You're going to marry my sister to gain control of the Baudelaire fortune. Or at least, that's what you plan to do. But when I show this information to Mr. Poe, your play will not be performed and you will go to jail.
Count Olaf's eyes grew very shiny, but he continued to smirk at Klaus. This was surprising. Klaus had guessed that once he announced what he knew, this dreadful man would have been very angry, even violent. After all, he'd had a furious outburst just because he'd wanted roast beef instead of puttanesca sauce. Surely he'd be even more enraged to have his plan discovered. But Count Olaf just sat there as calmly as if they were discussing the weather.
I guess you've found me out. I suppose you're right. I'll go to prison, and you and the other orphans will go free. Now, why don't you run up to your room and wake your sisters? I'm sure they'll want to know all about your grand victory over my evil ways.
Klaus looked closely at Count Olaf, who was continuing to smile as if he had just told a clever joke. Why wasn't he threatening Klaus in anger, or tearing his hair out in frustration, or running to pack his clothes and escape? This wasn't happening at all the way Klaus had pictured it.
Well, I will go tell my sisters.
Back in the bedroom, Violet was still dozing on the bed, and Sunny was still hidden beneath the curtains. Klaus woke Violet up first.
I stayed up all night reading, and I discovered what Count Olaf is up to. He plans to marry you for real, when you and Justice Strauss and everyone all think it's just a play. And once he's your husband, he'll have control of our parents' money, and he can dispose of us.
How can he marry me for real? It's only a play.
Klaus held up nuptial law to show his sister where he'd learned the information.
The only legal requirements of marriage in this community are your saying I do and signing the document in your own hand in the presence of a judge, like Justice Strauss.
But surely I'm not old enough to get married. I'm only 14.
Girls under the age of 18 can marry if they have the permission of their legal guardian. That's Count Olaf.
Oh, no. What can we do?
We can show the book to Mr. Poe, and he will finally believe us that Count Olaf is up to no good. Quick, get dressed while I wake up Sunny, and we can be at the bank by the time it opens.
Violet, who usually moved slowly in the mornings, nodded and immediately got out of bed and went to the cardboard box to find some proper clothing. Klaus walked over to the lump of curtains to wake up his younger sister.
Sunny? Sunny!
Klaus pulled away the top fold of the curtains to wake up the youngest Baudelaire child. But then he stopped. For underneath the curtain was nothing but another curtain. He moved aside all the layers, but his little sister was nowhere to be found.
Sunny!
Violet dropped the dress she was holding and began to help him search. They looked in every corner under the bed and even inside the cardboard box, but Sunny was gone.
Where can she be? She's not the type to run off.
Oh, where can she be, indeed?
Count Olaf was standing in the doorway, watching Violet and Klaus as they searched the room. His eyes were shining brighter than they ever had, and he was still smiling, like he just uttered a joke.
Yes, it certainly is strange to find a child missing, and one so small and helpless.
Where's Sunny? What have you done with her?
But then again, one sees strange things every day. In fact, if you two orphans follow me out to the backyard, I think we will all see something rather unusual.
The Baudelaire children followed Count Olaf through the house and out the back door. Violet looked around the small, scraggly yard, in which she had not been since she and Klaus had been forced to chop wood. The pile of logs they had made was still lying there untouched, as if Count Olaf had merely made them chop logs for his own amusement, rather than for any purpose. Violet shivered, still in her nightgown. But as she gazed here and there, she saw nothing unusual.
You're not looking in the right place. For children who read so much, you two are remarkably unintelligent.
Violet looked over in the direction of Count Olaf, but could not meet his eyes, the eyes on his face, that is. She was staring at his feet and could see the tattooed eye that had been watching the Baudelaire orphans since their troubles had begun. Then her eyes travelled up Count Olaf's lean, shabbily dressed body, and she saw that he was pointing up with one scrawny hand. She followed his gesture and found herself looking at the forbidden tower. It was made of dirty stone, with only one lone window, and just barely visible in the window was what looked like a bird cage.
Oh, no!
It was a bird cage, dangling from the tower window like a flag in the wind. But inside the bird cage, she could see a small and frightened Sunny. When Violet looked closely, she could see there was a large piece of tape across her sister's mouth and ropes around her body. She was utterly trapped. Count Olaf sat down on a stump.
Let her go. She has done nothing to you. She is an infant.
Well, now, if you really want me to let her go, I will.
But surely even a stupid brat like you might realize that if I let her go, or more accurately, if I ask my comrade to let her go, poor little Sonny might not survive the fall down to the ground. That's a 30-foot tower, which is a very long way for a very little person to fall, even when she's inside a cage. But if you insist...
No! Don't!
Violet looked into Count Olaf's eyes, and then at the small parcel that was her sister, hanging from the top of the tower and moving slowly in the breeze. She pictured Sunny toppling from the tower and onto the ground, pictured her sister's last thoughts being ones of sheer terror.
Please, she's just a baby. We'll do anything, anything. Just don't harm her.
Anything? Anything? Would you, for instance, consider marrying me during tomorrow night's performance?
Violet stared at him. She had an odd feeling in her stomach, as if she were the one being thrown from a great height. The really frightening thing about Olaf, she realized, was that he was very smart, after all. He wasn't merely an unsavory, drunken brute, but an unsavory, clever, drunken brute.
While you were busy reading books and making accusations, I had one of my quietest, sneakiest assistants skulk into your bedroom and steal little Sunny away. She is perfectly safe for now, but I consider her to be a stick behind a stubborn mule.
Our sister is not a stick!
A stubborn mule does not move in the direction its owner wants it to. In that way, it is like you children who insist on mucking up my plans. Any animal owner will tell you that a stubborn mule will move in the proper direction if there is a carrot in front of it and a stick behind it. It will move toward the carrot because it wants the reward of food, and away from the stick because it does not want the punishment of pain. Likewise, you will do what I say to avoid the punishment of the loss of your sister, and because you want the reward of surviving this experience. Now, Violet, let me ask you again. Will you marry me?
Violet swallowed and looked down at Count Olaf's tattoo. She could not bring herself to answer.
Come now.
Count Olaf reached out a hand and stroked Violet's hair, his voice faking, a word which here means feigning. Kindness.
Would it be so terrible to be my bride? To live in my house for the rest of your life? You're such a lovely girl. After the marriage, I wouldn't dispose of you like your brother and sister.
Violet imagined sleeping beside Count Olaf and waking up each morning to look at this terrible man. She pictured wandering around the house, trying to avoid him all day, and cooking for his terrible friends at night, perhaps every night, for the rest of her life. But then she looked up at her helpless sister and knew what her answer must be.
If you let Sunny go, I will marry you.
I will let Sunny go after tomorrow night's performance. In the meantime, she will remain in the tower for safekeeping. And as a warning, I will tell you that my assistants will stand guard at the door to the tower staircase, in case you were getting any ideas.
You're a terrible man.
I may be a terrible man, but I have been able to concoct a foolproof way of getting your fortune, which is more than you've been able to do. Remember that, orphans. You may have read more books than I have, but it didn't help you gain the upper hand in this situation. Now, give me that book which gave you such grand ideas, and do the chores assigned to you.
Klaus sighed and relinquished, a word which here means gave to Count Olaf, even though he didn't want to, the book on nuptial law. He began to follow Count Olaf into the house, but Violet stayed still as a statue. She hadn't been listening to that last speech of Count Olaf's, knowing it would be full of the usual self-congratulatory nonsense and despicable insults. She was staring at the tower, not at the top, where her sister was dangling, but the whole length of it. Klaus looked back at her and saw something he hadn't seen in quite some time. To those who hadn't been around Violet long, nothing would have seemed unusual, but those who knew her well knew that when she tied her hair up in a ribbon to keep it out of her eyes, it meant that the gears and levers of her inventing brain were whirring at top speed. That night, Klaus was the Baudelaire orphan sleeping fitfully in the bed, and Violet was the Baudelaire orphan staying up, working by the light of the moon. All day the two siblings had wandered around the house, doing the assigned chores, and scarcely speaking to each other. Klaus was too tired and despondent to speak, and Violet was holed up in the inventing area of her mind, too busy planning to talk. When night approached, Violet gathered up the curtains that had been Sunny's bed and brought them to the door to the tower stairs, where the enormous assistant of Count Olaf's, the one who looked like neither a man nor a woman, was standing guard. The enormous creature merely looked at Violet with its blank, white eyes and shook its head, then dismissed her with a silent gesture. Violet knew, of course, that Sunny was too terrified to be comforted by a handful of draperies, but she hoped that she would be allowed a few moments to hold her and tell her that everything would turn out all right. Also, she wanted to do something known in the crime industry as casing the joint. Casing the joint means observing a particular location in order to formulate a plan. For instance, if you are a bank robber, although I hope you aren't, you might go to the bank a few days before you plan to rob it, perhaps wearing a disguise. You would look around the bank and observe security guards, cameras, and other obstacles, so you could plan how to avoid capture or death during your burglary. Violet, a law-abiding citizen, was not planning to rob a bank, but she was planning to rescue Sunny, and was hoping to catch a glimpse of the tower room in which her sister was being held prisoner, so as to make her plan more easily. But it appeared that she wasn't going to be able to case the joint after all. This made Violet nervous, as she sat on the floor by the window, working on her invention as quietly as she could. Violet had very few materials with which to invent something, and she didn't want to wander around the house looking for more, for fear of arousing the suspicions of Count Olaf and his troop. But she had enough to build a rescuing device. Above the window was a sturdy metal rod from which the curtains had hung, and Violet took it down. Using one of the rocks Olaf had left in a pile in the corner, she broke the curtain rod into two pieces. She then bent each piece of the rod into several sharp angles, leaving tiny cuts on her hands as she did so. Then Violet took down the painting of the eye. On the back of the painting, as on the back of many paintings, was a small piece of wire to hang on the hook. She removed the wire and used it to connect the two pieces together. Violet had now made what looked like a large metal spider. She then went over to the cardboard box and took out the ugliest of the clothes that Mrs. Poe had purchased, the outfits the Baudelaire orphans would never wear, no matter how desperate they were. Working quickly and quietly, she began to tear these into long, narrow strips, and to tie these strips together. Among Violet's many useful skills was a vast knowledge of different types of knots. The particular knot she was using was called the Devil's Tongue. A group of female Finnish pirates invented it back in the 15th century and named it the Devil's Tongue because it twisted this way and that in a most complicated and eerie way. The Devil's Tongue was a very useful knot, and when Violet tied the cloth strips together, end to end, it formed a sort of rope. As she worked, She remembered something her parents had said to her when Klaus was born, and again when they brought Sunny home from the hospital.
You are the eldest Baudelaire child, and as the eldest, it will always be your responsibility to look after your younger siblings. Promise us that you will always watch out for them and make sure they don't get into trouble.
Violet remembered her promise and thought of Klaus, whose bruised face still looked sore, and Sunny, dangling from the top of the tower like a flag, and began working faster. Even though Count Olaf was, of course, the cause of all this misery, Violet felt as if she had broken her promise to her parents and vowed to make it right. Eventually, using enough of the ugly clothing, Violet had a rope that was, she hoped, just over 30 feet long. She tied one end of it to the metal spider and looked at her handiwork. What she had made was called a grappling hook, which is something used for climbing up the sides of buildings, usually for a nefarious purpose. Using the metal end to hook onto something at the top of the tower, and the rope to aid her climb, Violet hoped to reach the top of the tower, untie Sunny's cage, and climb back down. This was, of course, a very risky plan, both because it was dangerous, and because she had made the grappling hook herself, instead of purchasing it at a store that sold such things. But a grappling hook was all Violet could think of to make without a proper inventing laboratory. And time was running short. She hadn't told Klaus about her plan because she didn't want to give him false hope. So without waking him, she gathered up her grappling hook and tiptoed out of the room. Once outside, Violet realized her plan was even more difficult than she had thought. The night was quiet, which would mean she would have to make practically no noise at all. The night also had a slight breeze, and when she pictured herself swinging in the breeze, clinging to a rope made of ugly clothing, she almost gave up entirely. And the night was dark, so it was hard to see where she could toss the grappling hook and have the metal arms hook onto something. But standing there, shivering in her nightgown, Violet knew she had to try. Using her right hand, she threw the grappling hook as high and as hard as she could and waited to see if it would catch onto something. The hook made a loud noise as it hit the tower, but it didn't stick to anything and came crashing back down. Her heart pounding, Violet stood stock still, wondering if Count Olaf or one of his accomplices would come and investigate. But nobody arrived after a few moments, and Violet, swinging the hook over her head like a lasso, tried again. The grappling hook hit the tower twice as it bounced back down to the ground. Violet waited again, listening for footsteps, but all she heard was her own terrified pulse. She decided to try one more time. The grappling hook hit the tower and fell down again, hitting Violet hard in the shoulder. One of the arms tore her nightgown and cut through her skin. Biting down on her hand to keep from crying out in pain, Violet felt the place in her shoulder where she had been struck, and it was wet with blood. Her arm throbbed in pain. At this point in the proceedings, if I were Violet, I would have given up. But just as she was about to turn around and go inside the house, she pictured how scared Sunny must be. And ignoring the pain in her shoulder, Violet used her right hand to throw the hook again. Violet saw in the dim light of the moon that the hook wasn't falling. Nervously, she gave the rope a good yank, and it stayed put. The grappling hook had worked. Her feet touching the side of the stone tower and her hands grasping the rope, Violet closed her eyes and began to climb. Never daring to look around, She pulled herself up the tower, hand over hand, all the time keeping in mind her promise to her parents and the horrible things Count Olaf would do if his villainous plan worked. The evening wind blew harder and harder as she climbed higher and higher, and several times Violet had to stop climbing as the rope moved in the wind. She was certain that at any moment the cloth would tear, or the hook would slip, and Violet would be sent tumbling to her death. But thanks to her adroit inventing skills, the word adroit here means skillful, everything worked the way it was supposed to work, and suddenly Violet found herself feeling a piece of metal instead of a cloth rope. She opened her eyes and saw her sister Sunny, who was looking at her frantically and trying to say something past the strip of tape. Violet had arrived at the top of the tower, right at the window where Sunny was tied. The eldest Baudelaire orphan was about to grab her sister's cage and begin her descent when she saw something that made her stop. It was the spidery end of the grappling hook, which after several attempts had finally stuck onto something on the tower. Violet had guessed during her climb that it had found some notch in the stone, or part of the window, or perhaps a piece of furniture inside the tower room, and stuck there. But that wasn't what the hook had stuck on. Violet's grappling hook had stuck on another hook. It was one of the hooks on the hook-handed man, and his other hook, Violet saw, was glinting in the moonlight as it reached right toward her.
How pleasant that you could join us.
Violet immediately tried to scurry back down the rope, but Count Olaf's assistant was too quick for her. In one movement, he hoisted her into the tower room, and with a flick of his hook, sent her rescue device clanging to the ground. Now Violet was as trapped as her sister.
I'm so glad you're here. I was just thinking how much I wanted to see your pretty face. Have a seat.
What are you going to do with me?
I said, have a seat.
The hook-handed man pushed her into a chair. Violet looked around the dim and messy room. I'm certain that over the course of your own life, you have noticed that people's rooms reflect their personalities. In my room, for instance, I have gathered a collection of objects that are important to me, including a dusty accordion, on which I can play a few sad songs, a large bundle of notes on the activities of the Baudelaire orphans, and a blurry photograph, taken a very long time ago, of a woman whose name is Beatrice. These are items that are very precious and dear to me. The tower room held objects that were very dear and precious to Count Olaf. And they were terrible things. There were scraps of paper on which he had written his evil ideas in an illegible scrawl, lying in messy piles on top of the copy of nuptial law he had taken away from Klaus. There were a few chairs and a handful of candles which were giving off flickering shadows. Littered all over the floor were empty wine bottles and dirty dishes. But most of all were the drawings and paintings and carvings of eyes, big and small, all over the room. There were eyes painted on the ceilings and scratched into the grimy wooden floors. There were eyes scrawled along the windowsill, and one big eye painted on the knob of the door that led to the stairs. It was a terrible place. The hook-handed man reached into a pocket of his greasy overcoat and pulled out a walkie-talkie. With some difficulty, he pressed a button and waited a moment.
Boss, it's me. Your blushing bride just climbed up here to try and rescue the biting brat. I don't know, it's some sort of rope.
It was a grappling hook. I made it myself.
Violet tore off a sleeve of her nightgown to make a bandage for her shoulder.
She says it was a grappling hook. I don't know, boss. Yes, boss. Yes, boss, of course I understand she's yours. Yes, boss. Count Olaf is very displeased with his bride.
I'm not his bride!
Very soon you will be.
The hook-handed man wagged his hook, the way most people would wag a finger.
In the meantime, however, I have to go and fetch your brother. The three of you will be locked in this room until night falls. That way, Count Olaf can be sure you will all stay out of mischief.
With that, the hook-handed man stomped out of the room. Violet immediately went over to Sunny and put a hand on her little head. Afraid to untie or untape her sister for fear of incurring, a word which here means bringing about, Count Olaf's wrath, Violet stroked Sunny's hair and murmured that everything was all right. But of course everything was not all right. Everything was all wrong. As the first light of morning trickled into the tower room, Violet reflected on all the awful things she and her siblings had experienced recently. Their parents had died suddenly and horribly. Mrs. Poe had bought them ugly clothing. They had moved into Count Olaf's house and were treated terribly. Mr. Poe had refused to help them. They had discovered a fiendish plot involving marrying Violet and stealing the Baudelaire fortune. Klaus had tried to confront Olaf with knowledge he'd learned in Justice Strauss's library and failed. Poor Sunny had been captured. And now Violet had tried to rescue Sunny and found herself captured as well. All in all, the Baudelaire orphans had encountered catastrophe after catastrophe, and Violet found their situation lamentably deplorable. A phrase which here means it was not at all enjoyable. The sound of footsteps coming up the stairs brought Violet out of her thoughts, and soon the hook-handed man opened the door and thrust a very tired, confused, and scared Klaus into the room.
Here's the last orphan. And now I must go help Count Olaf with final preparations for tonight's performance. No monkey business, you two, or I will have to tie you up and let you dangle out of the window as well.
Klaus blinked and looked around the filthy room. He was still in his pajamas.
What has happened? Why are we up here?
I tried to rescue Sunny using an invention of mine to climb up the tower.
Klaus went over to the window and looked down at the ground.
It's so high up. You must have been terrified.
It was very scary, but not as scary as the thought of marrying Count Olaf.
I'm sorry your invention didn't work.
Violet rubbed her sore shoulder.
The invention worked fine. I just got caught. And now we're doomed. The hook-handed man said he'd keep us here until tonight. And then it's the marvelous marriage.
Do you think you could invent something that would help us escape?
Maybe. And why don't you go through those books and papers? Perhaps there's some information that could be of use.
For the next few hours, Violet and Klaus searched the room and their own minds for anything that might help them. Violet looked for objects with which she could invent something. Klaus read through Count Olaf's papers and books. From time to time, they would go over to Sunny and smile at her and pat her head to reassure her. Occasionally, Violet and Klaus would speak to each other, but mostly they were silent, lost in their own thoughts.
If we had any kerosene, I could make Molotov cocktails with these bottles.
What are Molotov cocktails?
They're small bombs made inside bottles. We could throw them out the window and attract the attention of passers-by.
But we don't have any kerosene.
They were silent for several hours.
If we were polygamists, Count Olaf's marriage plan wouldn't work.
What are polygamists?
Polygamists are people who marry more than one person. In this community, polygamists are breaking the law. Even if they have married in the presence of a judge, with the statement of I do and the signed document in their own hand. I read it here in nuptial law.
But we're not polygamists.
They were silent for several more hours.
We could break these bottles in half and use them as knives, but I'm afraid that Count Olaf's troop would overpower us.
You could say I don't instead of I do, but I'm afraid Count Olaf would order Sunny dropped off the tower.
I certainly would.
Both of the children jumped. They had been so involved in their conversation that they hadn't heard him come up the stairs and open the door. He was wearing a fancy suit, and his eyebrow had been waxed, so it looked as shiny as his eyes. Behind him stood the hook-handed man, who smiled and waved a hook at the young